was almost always well-suited for the human voice. Even an Ellington masterpiece, such as Sophisticated Lady, remains essentially an instrumental number, employing intervallic gymnastics in the bridge that would defy all but the most determined crooner. Carter's genius, in contrast, lay in crafting horn lines that implicitly retained their connectedness to the vocal art. The singing quality to Carter's work is also the key to understanding his contributions as a soloist. A lazy elegance marks his finest work, whether on trumpet or saxophone. In his 1940 Chocolate Dandy session, he matches up with Coleman Hawkins and Roy Eldridge in a magisterial frontline, but breaks the cardinal rule of improvising by starting with climactic energy, then slowly bringing down the temperature until he is gliding softly over the chords in characteristic Carter fashion. Even earlier, on Nightfall, 1936, Carter showed, on the tenor sax in this instance, how to play Hawkins' own instrument in a cool, lithe manner. Usually, Lester Young is credited with this contribution to the evolution of the tenor, but Nightfall was recorded a half year before Young's own debut session. This distilled approach became especially prominent in the post-war period, when Carter resisted the dominant Parker alto sound. On his 1961 recording of The Midnight Sun Will Never Set, he displays a bop-like fluidity, but retains a relaxed sense of phrasing and his deeply personal, sweet, at times almost overripe, tone. Equally noteworthy, however, is the rigorously logical development of Carter's improvisations. In the 1950s, Sonny Rollins would be lauded for showing the virtues of thematic improvisation, for using his saxophone to dissect, analyze, and develop melodic material, much as a classical composer might attempt in the context of sonata form. Yet Carter's work from two decades earlier evinces a comparable mastery of thematic development. Even as an improviser, he thought like a composer. After disbanding his orchestra in 1946, Carter worked for a period with Norman Granz's various Jazz at the Philharmonic ensembles, and supplemented his income with miscellaneous projects and recordings, some jazz-oriented, but others showing his fluency in a range of commercial idioms. By the mid-1950s, Carter's performances had taken a backseat to his work as an arranger, primarily for many of the leading singers of the day, including Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald, and Ray Charles. In his mid-60s, at the brink of what might otherwise be his retirement years, Carter resurfaced as an instrumentalist. The last major figure of his generation to remain active in jazz, Carter increasingly garnered accolades, honorary degrees, commissions, and awards, somehow both fitting and ironic, given the modest and soft-spoken demeanor with which he had always viewed his own work. Despite his self-effacing comments, Carter put to excellent use the opportunities that this second wind in his career provided, and he stayed active into the new millennium. At his death in 2003, obituaries boasted that this artist had made recordings during 9 different decades. Others have matched or surpassed Carter's longevity as a jazz performer, but few have written so many fine compositions so late in life. In 1987, Carter's extended work, Central City Sketches, was given its premiere at a concert by the American Jazz Orchestra at Cooper Union. Later that same year, Carter's Glasgow Suite made its debut in Scotland. A 1990 commission by Lincoln Center resulted in Good Vibes, a work for 2 vibraphones and orchestra. A grant from the National Endowment for the Arts assisted in the performance and recording of 2 new suites in 1992, Tales of the Rising Sun Suite and Harlem Renaissance Suite. Almost 85 years old at the time these last pieces made their debut, Carter showed himself still capable of maintaining the high-quality standards he had set in previous decades. The melodic warmth and robust musicality of his early work are, if anything, heightened in these late vintages. But a sensitive channeling of elements drawn from modern jazz can also be heard, albeit in a manner that is never derivative. Somehow, Carter reconciles progressivism with the aesthetic dictates and proclivities of the pre-bop tradition. If Carter were of a polemical bent, these later works might have taken on the overtones of a counter-revolution in jazz, an African-American pre-Raphaelitism, one built on structure, balance, economy of means, and an aversion to the querulous and self-questioning tone. For Carter, the jazz idiom provided a set of tools that he could use in setting a mood. Some might chafe at such a description. These days, we are inclined to dismiss mood music as a lesser art, as an emaciated form of creativity. Yet, as Carter's vast body of work attests, mood music is by no means equivalent to background music. As practiced by the best, the ability to establish an authentic emotional scenario, to create a sonic environment so compelling as to envelop the audience, this is not a simple or simple-minded task, but perhaps the most time-honored wellspring of art. The willing suspension of disbelief is what such submersion in the artistic vision was called in an earlier day. Among his contemporaries, Carter was second only to Duke Ellington in this skill. But then again, no figure in jazz history could surpass Ellington in creating a completely satisfying and self-sufficient musical mood. And though it is increasingly fashionable to analyze Duke's work in the jargon of academic musicology, the magic of his artistry cannot be reduced merely to a series of breakthroughs in orchestration or harmony. True, the techniques Ellington employed were impressive, but it was always the ends he achieved, not the means, that distinguished the Ellington band from the rest. This commitment to the mood, an unfashionable artistic pursuit in our postmodern age, eludes our grasp. Yet it draws us again and again to Duke's recordings, and it is why, after listening to them, we inevitably reach for metaphors from other fields to describe Ellington's spell. The painter of musical landscapes, the poet of jazz, the alchemist of the swing band. And as the consummate creator of these settings, Ellington the man was equally elusive. So skilled at putting on the mask of the momentary mood, the man underneath often remained, almost by necessity, hidden from view. Duke Ellington's early career. One of the quaint, if puzzling, eccentricities of jazz lay in its apparent obsession with titles of nobility and statesmanship. Bolden, Keppard, Oliver, all at one time were nicknamed King, while later leading or lesser lights came to be known, both by their fans and peers, as Duke, Count, Lady, Sir, Prince, and Baron. Before long, a pan-global sensibility replaced these Eurocentric trappings, ushering in an era in which anything from president to pharaoh could serve as a suitable jazz alias. Of all these figures, none lived up to the image of nobility better than Duke Ellington. Elegant, reserved without being stiff, articulate even in his evasions, well-mannered to the point of ostentation, elitist despite his populist tendencies, always ready with a compliment, a high-flown phrase, or a measured response to deflect the most pointed inquiry, Edward Kennedy Ellington would have been a striking man even if he had never played a note of music. Yet these self-same qualities, ones that make Ellington an admirable role model, pose problems for historians and biographers. This middle-class youth, who made himself into a duke, was equally a master at recrafting his biography to match the dimensions of his aspirations and keeping a close guard over his inner life. Probe as deeply as we can, he remains the duke, the private man subsumed by the public persona. Once upon a time, a beautiful young lady and a very handsome young man fell in love and got married. They were a wonderful, compatible couple, and God blessed their marriage with a fine baby boy. Thus begins Ellington's own account of his life and times, as presented in his autobiography, Music is My Mistress. No doubt Ellington viewed his own life in storybook terms, but the elegance of his childhood was more a matter of the family's self-image than a result of affluence or social position. His father, James Edward Ellington, had been working as a waiter when, 2 years before his son's birth, he took on a position as a servant in the home of a Washington, D.C. doctor. For 2 decades, throughout his son's formative years, the elder Ellington stayed with his employer, moving up the ranks from coachman to butler. By all accounts, the father's sense of fashion, bearing, and grandiloquent manner of self-expression were the model for his son's later assumption of the high style. Ellington's mother, Daisy Kennedy Ellington, came from a more successful family. Her father was a police captain. Pretty, cultivated, proper, she represented the establishment ideals to which her husband aspired. Family finances may have been modest, but once again the image was what mattered most. Duke recalled that his father always acted as though he had money, whether he had it or not. In this unusual household, servants' quarters with a decorum of a feudal manner, a son, Edward Kennedy Ellington was born on April 29, 1899. An earlier Ellington child apparently died in infancy, and the mother now focused her undivided attention on Edward, as did much of the extended family. "I was pampered and pampered and spoiled rotten by all the women in the family," Ellington later remarked. But the coddling of the doting mother was tempered by her focus on providing a moral education and her determined view that her son was destined for special achievements, a view that he too came to adopt. "Do I believe that I am blessed?" he asked rhetorically in his autobiography. "Of course I do. In the first place, my mother told me so many, many times, and when she did, it was always quietly, confidently." Inculcated almost from the cradle, this sense of self-importance would become a defining element in Ellington's character. Even in his youth, he amazed and irritated his cousins, announcing to them, "I am the grand noble duke." Two pianos graced the Ellington residence, and both parents showed some skill at playing them. Before their son reached his 10th birthday, he had received lessons from a local music teacher, aptly named Mrs. Clinkscales. From all indications, this early introduction to the piano made little impression on Ellington, and by his adolescence, an interest in the visual arts had taken hold of him. He attended a vocational high school and contemplated a career as a commercial artist. Had he been a more dedicated student, Ellington might never have considered music as anything more than a hobby. Instead, his interest in school waned, and he left before earning his diploma. Despite his limitations as a pianist, by his own admission he only knew three or four songs at the time, opportunities to perform, first among friends but soon for pay, were starting to come his way. Although his parents' idea of acceptable music stopped far short of ragtime and blues, the young Ellington had already grown familiar with these new styles. A Washington, D.C. pool room that he frequented was a gathering spot for the local rag pianists, and before long, Ellington was learning various tricks of the keyboard trade from the best of them, and substituting for the regulars at engagements. Around this same time, a high school music teacher, Henry Grant, invited Ellington to come by his house for private lessons in harmony. Duke's musical education was also furthered by surreptitious visits to burlesque shows, where he learned not only popular music styles, but also, one suspects, elements of showmanship. Ellington's musical education was proceeding on many fronts, but the Harlem Stride style of pianism made the deepest impression on the youngster's imagination. He studied the piano rolls of James P. Johnson and learned the Stride Master's Carolina Shout note for note. When Johnson came to Washington, D.C., Ellington performed it for him and earned the older pianist's encouragement. Rote learning, however, played only a limited role in the youngster's musical education. Almost from the start, Ellington preferred writing his own compositions, and his zest for learning about music was never greater than when he could apply the pedagogical models at hand to his own efforts. Ellington's later evolution as a jazz composer followed this same pattern. He preferred to learn by doing rather than by analyzing scores, attending classes, or reading textbooks on composition and harmony. Formal study, to the degree he pursued it, was undertaken to meet his practical needs as a composer, not as a means of assimilating abstract theory. And like all great autodidacts, Ellington may have learned more slowly than he might have with an organized regimen. But he eventually learned with a far deeper grasp of the practicalities of his craft than any textbook could have provided. Until his late teens, Ellington continued to view music as a sideline. But in 1918, he married Edna Thompson, whom he had known since childhood, and the following year, their son Mercer was born. Now, the responsibilities of supporting a family forced Ellington to think seriously about the career paths open to him. The goal of working as a commercial artist persisted for a period. Ellington even began a sign painting business that allowed him to design dance posters and advertising materials. Around this same time, he earned an NAACP scholarship to study art at the Pratt Institute in New York. Yet Ellington's activities in music continued to blossom, and not just as a player. He began booking other bands, sometimes sending out several in a night, in addition to taking on his own gigs. By 1923, Ellington had established himself as a leading light of the Washington, D.C. dance band scene, and had embarked on musical associations with drummer Sonny Greer and saxophonist Otto Hardwick, among others, that would play an important role in his future. A less ambitious man might have remained content with this comfortable state of affairs, but Ellington, conscious of being marked for greater accomplishments, set his sights on making his name in New York. Together with Hardwick and Greer, he took a sideman's job with a New York band, aiming to use it as a springboard to bigger things. Rather than taking Manhattan by storm, Ellington and his friends scuffled for work in their new setting, and before long retreated to Washington. Chastened but not deterred, Ellington returned to sign painting and performing, but within months was drawn again to New York. Now he worked assiduously to advance his career on several fronts. He began auditioning songs for music publishers, expanding his network of New York contacts, and performing with a contingent of fellow musicians from D.C. who had also made the move to Manhattan. A chance encounter with singer Ada Smith, who would later enliven Paris nightlife under the name Bricktop, led to an engagement backing her at a Harlem nightclub. Within a short while, Ellington's band, working under the name The Washingtonians, had moved to a downtown gig at the Hollywood Club near Times Square. The band would work at this location, which was renamed the Club Kentucky in 1924, although typically referred to by Ellington and others as the Kennedy Club, for the next 4 years. At some point during this period, Ellington took over as nominal leader of the band. Leadership is a relative concept in the often free-form world of jazz, and Ellington's sidemen showed, more than most, a resistance to overt forms of control from above. Even so, Ellington soon began to demonstrate the genius for organizing and supervising that would come to distinguish his band from its peers. How much influence Ellington had on the choice of James Boober Miley to replace the departing trumpeter Arthur Wetzel is unclear. Yet the move has all the marks of Ellington's uncanny knack for finding the right individual to advance his own musical vision. Many other band leaders would have passed on Miley. His technical facility was, at best, average. His gift for melodic improvisation, as evidenced by his knack for milking one or two notes for all they were worth, would have struck many as limited. His range was far from impressive. Yet Miley's instinct for tonal color, for shaping a melody, for bringing a horn line to life was unsurpassed. As a standalone soloist, he might have been several notches below an Armstrong or a Beiderbecke, but as the melodic voice for Ellington's compositions, he would set the standard. And in one respect, Miley was superior to these more acclaimed players. In his mastery of the plunger and straight mute, he was without peer. This South Carolina native, raised in New York, looked to the New Orleans stylist King Oliver for inspiration. Long after most of his contemporaries had adopted the more modern approaches of Armstrong and Beiderbecke, Miley maintained his allegiance to this early master of the muted cornet. Ellington's next major personnel move confirmed the new, unusual direction he envisioned for the band. When trombonist Charlie Irvis departed in 1926, Ellington brought in Tricky Sam Nanton. As with Miley, the choice of Nanton would have been far from obvious to most bandleaders. His facility with the slide was limited, and his range was constrained. Yet again, like Miley, Nanton was a master of the dirty tone and could make his horn talk in a language that was almost human. Already the pattern of Ellington's future direction could be seen in embryonic form. At this point in his career, Ellington could not afford to hire star soloists, although he tried for a while to keep Sidney Bechet in the band. So he compensated by employing the most distinctive stylists he could find. The end result was a band that may have offered little in the way of virtuosity, as measured in cold, metronomic terms, but boasted an excess of character. Ellington's own piano style fit in well with this approach. It may have lacked the polished execution of a Waller, the dazzling speed of a Tatum, the soft swing of a Basie, or the riveting electricity of a Hines, but for sheer variety and exoticism, in its surprising twists and turns, the Duke's pianism was nonpareil. This preference for the unusual would remain a calling card of Ellington's music over the next several decades. Almost from the start, listeners were drawn by the novelty of these new sounds. The earliest known review of the band, dating from 1923, praises Miley's ability to exact the eeriest sort of modulations and singing notes heard. Another reviewer cited Miley as responsible for all that slow, weird music. However, the initial recordings of the band only hint at the originality of Ellington's conception. As early as the spring of 1926, Ellington's ambitions could be seen in his choice to augment his small working band with additional players for record sessions. But the music still primarily reflects influences from other quarters, from Oliver, from Henderson, from the New York Sweet Bands. But with the November 1926 recording of East St. Louis Toodaloo, a more vibrant and original conception jumps to the fore. A foreboding progression of block chords, voiced for saxophones and tuba, sets up the opening theme, which is played by Miley with magnificent guttural intensity. The emotional level diminishes with the entrance of the second theme, a lighthearted bit of derivative syncopation, but the overall impact of the piece is powerful. True, various conventional devices of the day can still be detected. The shift from an ominous minor melody to a rag-inflected major theme was a stock-in-trade of the Stride School. The solos outside of Miley's are merely workmanlike, but the sense of a new stylistic direction for the Ellington Band can be clearly heard. Black and Tan Fantasy from April of the following year, the first of three Ellington versions of this composition recorded in 1927, represents a second stage in the evolution of this new sound. Once again, Miley's trenchant mute work over a minor theme is used to fullest effect, but the contrasting melody in major is a strong lyrical statement several notches above the tepidly swinging second section of East St. Louis Toodaloo. The atmosphere of this composition is, if anything, darker still than the earlier piece, so much so that the band closes with a fitting allusion to Chopin's Funeral March. Miley's solo work is superlative, and it is not going too far to suggest that his various performances of this composition represent classic statements in the history of jazz trumpet playing, worthy to stand alongside the more celebrated contributions of Armstrong and Beiderbecke. His mastery of tone remains the defining quality of his artistic vision and gives a human quality to his music beyond the scope of written scores to convey. Yet this virtue tends to draw attention away from his ingenuity and melodic improvisation. Even when notated, when engraved in the dull medium of black notes on a page, his solos here retain a penetrating vitality despite the absence of the evocative growls and moans of his recorded delivery. His role in most histories of jazz, in essence playing attendant lord to Ellington's Hamlet, does not do full justice to his achievements. In Creole Love Call from the following year, Ellington displays a more ruminative side of his musical personality, crafting one of the first substantial statements in a long series of meditative tone poems from the pre-war years. Others include Mood Indigo, Solitude, and Prelude to a Kiss, many of which would become permanent staples in the band's repertoire. But even in the subdued atmosphere of Creole Love Call, Ellington's fascination with exotic sounds takes precedence. Singer Adelaide Hall joins the band and contributes a plaintive, wordless vocal that, at moments, takes on a rough edge comparable to, and likely inspired by, Miley's mute work. The scoring, although understated, adds to the melancholy flavor of the piece, and is especially noteworthy for Ellington's varied use of call-and-response exchanges. The question of Ellington's originality has often been raised with reference to these and other works. Certainly, there can be little doubt, given the various accounts that have come down to us, about Duke's willingness to borrow whatever musical materials suited his needs. Even though Ellington's name graces the credits of these early compositions, Miley's contribution may have, at times, matched or even surpassed Duke's own. And appropriations from other sidemen would prove to be an ongoing formula for Ellington throughout his career. Nor were band members his only source of inspiration. Creole Love Call is just one instance of his delving into riffs and themes that were already part of the jazz heritage, in this case drawing from an earlier piece credited to King Oliver. Even tiny musical flourishes were likely to have antecedents. The reference to Chopin in Black and Tan Fantasy mimics Jelly Roll Morton's similar use of the Funeral March theme in Dead Man Blues just a few months earlier. While Ellington's frequent adoption of the techniques of the Harlem Stride players has already been noted. Yet through it all, Ellington's genius lay in adapting the materials of others to his own ends, in weaving the strands and threads of music that he gathered into what can only be described as the Ellington sound. And though Miley's contributions may have been great, he remains, perhaps due to his early death before the age of 30, one of the most taken-for-granted figures of early jazz. Ellington's ability to survive the trumpeter's departure and take the band to an even higher level in the following years remains a telling achievement. It gives needed emphasis to the point that it was Ellington's skill in pulling together the historical sources and passing inspirations into memorable compositions, more than any given raw materials he employed along the way, that distinguished his unique musical aptitude. The end result was a body of music that not only reflected the character of his players, but was perfectly suited to their strengths and weaknesses. Duke studied his men, Barney Biggard has explained. He studied their style, how they maneuver with their music, with their playing and everything. And he keeps that in mind, so if he wrote anything for you, it fit you like a glove. If he'd see where a guy had got some type of talent, added Cootie Williams, he'd go along with him. Yes, I am the world's greatest listener, Ellington himself wrote in his 1973 autobiography. Here I am, 50 years later, still getting cats out of bed to come to work so that I can listen to them. And listen Ellington did, consummately, deeply, and out of the listening, extract from each player the essence of his musical personality, out of each section its unique character, out of the whole band a sound like no other. Competing ensembles may have sometimes had more raw talent on an individual level, but somehow Ellington was able to create, in aggregate, an ensemble that was second to none. Even at this early stage of his musical development, Ellington's work revealed a coherent unity of vision, an overarching design that stood out from the pack. Ellington's attentiveness to this vision appears to have extended even to the technical aspects of recordings. The sonic balance and authenticity are carefully gauged, much more so than one finds with Henderson or the other bands of the day, to create a satisfying, holistic musical experience. One suspects that this was more than happenstance, but another sign of Ellington's working behind the scenes. In the spring of 1927, Ellington was poised to take the next major step in his career. He had gained a dedicated following at the Club Kentucky, had embarked upon a fertile period of composition and record-making. During the late 1920s, Ellington would take his band into the studio almost every month, and had gone a long way toward forging a style of his own. Around this same time, Irving Mills, whom Ellington had met during his earliest days in New York, began taking a more active role in managing Duke's business affairs. Although the extent of Mills's contributions can be debated, especially with regard to his supposed musical collaborations with Ellington, his instincts for promoting the band would prove to be first-rate. The final piece in the puzzle fit into place when, later that year, the Ellington Band was selected to fill an opening at the Cotton Club in Harlem. Looking back at this signal event, Ellington liked to point to his luck in winning the spot. According to his account, the club's manager showed up too late to hear the other six bands that had auditioned and selected Dukes by default. But luck would have little to do with the successes he would soon achieve in this new setting. Through the hard work and ceaseless ambition of these apprenticeship years, Duke Ellington had prepared himself for just such a springboard to celebrity and was now determined to make the most of it. The Cotton Club. The burst of creative energy brought about by the Harlem Renaissance did not long remain a secret to white audiences. The written word was the first to travel below the demarcating line, drawn at 110th Street, which separated black Harlem from white New York. Alan Locke's pathbreaking The New Negro spread news of the movement on its appearance in 1925. But even earlier works such as James Weldon Johnson's The Book of American Negro Poetry, 1922, had already signaled the emergence of a new literary culture. In neo-minstrel fashion, white writers were attracted by the primitivist ethos they perceived in these works and, donning a linguistic equivalent of blackface, concocted a host of derivative efforts. Notable examples of black fiction by white writers included Waldo Frank's Holiday, 1923, Sherwood Anderson's Dark Laughter, 1924, and Carl Van Vechten's Nigger Heaven, 1926. In the world of Harlem nightlife, the consumption of black entertainment by an affluent white clientele came to be known as slumming. In earlier years, the white audience had waited until black music came to it. A series of shows, In Dahomey, 1902, In Abyssinia, 1906, and Bandana Land, 1907, among others, had titillated New York whites with glimpses of black entertainment that, for all their stereotypes, were far more authentic than the diluted minstrel efforts of earlier years. The turning point, however, was the highly successful revue Shuffle Along, which opened at the 63rd Street Music Hall in 1921. Shuffle Along drew large audiences with its talent-laden collection of black artists, both on stage and behind the scenes, including Paul Robeson, Florence Mills, William Grant Still, Adelaide Hall, Noble Sissel, and Ubi Blake, and represented a major advance for African Americans in the New York entertainment industry. But white America was not content to remain passive spectators at black artistry. Especially when they took to the dance floor, they were increasingly drawing on the steps and movements created by African Americans. We have already witnessed the symbiotic relationship between the cutting-edge popular dance styles of Vernon and Irene Castle and the music of James Reese Europe, as well as the assimilation of the cakewalk and turkey trot into the ballrooms of mainstream America. The linkages between black dance music, jazz music, and the broader culture were furthered in the 1920s with the popularity of the Charleston, the shimmy, and the black bottom. Harlem participated in this process and in many ways drove it, serving in the late 1920s and 1930s as the epicenter of fervent dance activity that would set the model for the next stage in this evolutionary process. Opened in 1926, the Savoy Ballroom represented the new ethos at its highest pitch. It boasted a spacious dance floor of 250 by 50 feet, fronted by two bandstands with a special section, the so-called Cat's Corner, where the best dancers could display their moves. As the famous song title asserted, the patrons were truly stompin' at the Savoy, so much so that management needed to replace the burnished maple dance floor every 3 years. From the start, the Savoy was fully integrated, and not only did white dancers make their way to this Harlem night spot, but the dances of the Savoy also came downtown, and from there eventually spread across the nation. When choreographer Frederick Ashton required dancers for Four Saints in Three Acts, the modernist opera by Virgil Thompson and Gertrude Stein, he quickly moved to scout the talent on the Savoy floor. But popular dance styles were even more impacted by these Harlem proceedings. The Lindy Hop, named after aviator Charles Lindbergh's famous 1927 solo Hop Across the Atlantic, gained widespread notoriety only after Herbert White, the head bouncer at the Savoy, organized some ballroom regulars into a group known as Whitey's Lindy Hoppers. As the dance gained popularity with young white Americans, it became widely known as the Jitterbug, although it underwent a subtle transformation in the process, with the horizontal movements of the Lindy Hop taking on a more vertical jumping motion. With the rise of swing in the late 1930s and its acceptance by young Americans of all colors, the central role of dance in the music continued unabated. Swing music was inseparable from swing dancing, and the competitions on the floor, judged by a jury of one's peers selected from among the patrons, was as much a main event as the proceedings on the bandstand. Even when Benny Goodman played at Carnegie Hall, the newspapers reported the teenagers were literally dancing in the aisles. The financial ramifications of these developments in theater and dance were not lost on promoters and impresarios. The procurement of black entertainment for white audiences soon became, inevitably and fortuitously, a mini-industry, a burgeoning microcosm of New York nightlife as a whole. Their appetite whetted by these dances and shows, white audiences began seeking even greater verisimilitude in their samplings of African-American culture. But even when journeying into Harlem to witness them firsthand, these spectators nonetheless demanded venues that protected their positions as ruling class elites. In this context, the grotesque spectacle of the Harlem Club for all white audiences was born, a musical menagerie in which social proximity and distance could coexist. At the height of the jazz age, Harlem featured 11 nightclubs that catered to high-class whites, as well as 500 colored cabarets of lower ranks, according to Variety. It is easy to condemn the leading Harlem establishments for the patronizing attitudes on which they were built. Nonetheless, they served to mitigate, however clumsily, the currents of racism that were running rampant in other social institutions. In America, music was the first sphere of social interaction in which racial barriers were challenged and overturned. And the challenge went both ways. By the mid-1920s, white bands were playing for all black audiences at Lincoln Theater and elsewhere. These intermediate steps between segregation and integration represented, for all their problems, progress of sorts. Yet from a purely musical perspective, the contributions of the Harlem clubs were almost wholly laudable. Channeling the financial means of white society into black artistry, they created a staging point for a cultural fermentation that would transform American music for good. Connie's Inn, on the corner of 131st Street and 7th Avenue, may have been a tawdry bootlegger showplace, but it was also the birthplace of Fats Waller's Hot Chocolate Show that brought Louis Armstrong and a number of memorable songs to the attention of a wider public. Other night spots, Ed Small's Paradise, Broadway Joe's Supper Club, Barron's Exclusive Club, for all the faux pearl glamour and underworld connections, also served as spawning grounds for an African-American artistic revolution that would prove to be, with the passing of time, every bit as important as the more highbrow literary and dramatic achievements of the Harlem Renaissance. Among all these venues, the most important, the Carnegie Hall for those who could not perform at Carnegie Hall, was the Cotton Club. But the ambience here was far removed from concert hall propriety, where the more adventurous New Yorkers went for nightlife in those prohibition years. They expected alcohol, and where alcohol flowed, organized crime usually ran the tap. Opened in 1923 by Oney Madden and his gang, Oney had recently been released from Sing Sing after serving 8 years for murder, the Cotton Club served as the most glamorous distribution outlet for Madden's bootleg beer business. The confluence of mobsters, money, and music may have created opportunities for Ellington, but with it came added pressures. In addition to playing its standard repertoire, the group now took on responsibility for backing up the other Cotton Club acts, a daunting challenge for a band that had, for all its merits, grown comfortable performing charts written to accentuate the instrumentalists' strengths and avoid their weaknesses. But the demands of the new setting were as much psychological as musical. When I went to the Cotton Club, Sonny Greer recalls, they put pressure on. They put pressure on us, and no denying at that time, when the syndicate say they want something, they got it, or you wasn't in the business. Yet Ellington was well suited to thrive in this new environment. His sense of showmanship, his own perfectionist tendencies, his ambitions, these were now given a suitably grand setting for their expression. By the close of his Cotton Club years, Ellington would have parlayed this opportunity into a position of preeminence, establishing his group as the most critically acclaimed African-American band of its day. Although Ellington had previously expanded his group for recordings, the Club Kentucky engagement had supported only a sextet. Now required to front a much larger band, Ellington again displayed his unerring knack for finding the right individual ingredients for the complex new sounds he was in the process of concocting. In this defining moment, when he was on the cusp of stardom, Ellington brought in a core group of players who would stay with him for years, in some instances for decades, and help him create more than a passing style, but in essence serve as building blocks for their employer's lifelong vocation as a composer and bandleader. Until this point, Ellington's brass players had taken the lead in the giving the band an original personality, but now Duke's new additions to the reed section would change the group in a similarly decisive manner. Saxophonist Harry Carney had played with Duke on a New England tour before the Cotton Club engagement, but now began a full-time association that would last almost a half century. His rich baritone lines would anchor the Ellington sax section and contribute greatly to the group's overall sound. At times, Ellington would assign the higher intervals of a chord to Carney's baritone, a striking effect that brought an ethereal quality to the section work. In other contexts, Carney served as an important solo voice, adding a languorous, weighty character to many of Duke's mood pieces. Carney had grown up in Boston, where he had lived down the street from Johnny Hodges, another saxophonist who joined Ellington around the time of the Cotton Club engagement. Hodges, whose career with Ellington spanned over 40 years, may have lacked the versatility of a Benny Carter, the vigor of a Coleman Hawkins, or the fluency of a Frank Trumbauer, yet no other player of his generation forged such a deeply personal approach to the saxophone. Like Miley and Nanton, Hodges produced a tone so rich that even a single note could resonate with a universe of emotion. Nicknamed the Rabbit, One explanation linked it to his preference for lettuce and tomato sandwiches, another to his fast footwork. Hodges was more like the tortoise in his approach to the saxophone. Breathy phrases often tarried far behind the beat, and at times took on a delicious, liquid quality, especially when Hodges delivered one of his calling cards, a lazy glissando sliding from the low to high register of the horn. It remains to this day one of the most singular sounds in the history of jazz. Hodges was especially effective on slow numbers. Indeed, no other soloist in the band played a more important role in defining the character of Ellington's ballads, but also ranked among the finer, although rarely acknowledged, masters of the blues. Clarinetist Barney Bigard, another newcomer to the Ellington band during this time, would boast only a 15-year tenure with the band, making him a transient compared to the other lifers in the group, although this would be a lengthy stint by the measure of any other jazz band. Playing the Albert System clarinet, favored by so many other New Orleans pioneers, among them his own teacher, Lorenzo Tio Jr., Bigard extracted a rich, woody tone from his instrument. In an apt comparison, Ellington suggested that the delicacy of Bigard's melodic lines was akin to the beautiful filigree work in wrought iron so characteristic of the clarinetist's hometown. Bigard's playing never lost its strong ties to the traditional New Orleans style, and though that idiom was somewhat at odds with the direction the band was now taking, Ellington delighted in Bigard's clarinet as one more highly personal sound in an orchestra of distinctive voices. Performing 6 nights a week at the Cotton Club, participating in radio broadcasts, and recording prolifically, Ellington now needed to increase his own productivity. These new settings also demanded greater versatility, given the wide range of acts the band was now supporting with its music. Despite these pressures, Ellington flourished in the face of recurrent deadlines, expanding considerably his range of compositional devices and refining his skills in orchestration. Black Beauty, a piece Ellington recorded several times during this period, indicates the scope of these changes. It opens with an introductory sequence of rich chords which linger ambiguously over an uncertain harmonic center before finally settling into a wistful melody in the key of B-flat, while the jazzier second theme emerges after an uncharacteristic modulation into A-flat. This adventurous approach to tonality, unusual in jazz or popular music at the time, would become an Ellington trademark. Especially noteworthy was Ellington's willingness to use dissonance and polytonality, at times crossing the border into atonality. These remarkable passages would sometimes appear only in an introduction, as in Black Beauty, or even more magnificently, in opening the second movement of Black, Brown, and Beige from 1943. Occasionally, they linger longer, as in Ellington's inspired vignette, The Clothed Woman, from 1947. But most often, these surprising interjections would surface for one or two bars in the middle of a piece, before subsiding into the fold of a more conventional harmonic sequence. Majestically, imperiously, Ellington made progressive composition and popular music share the same stage. Duke's approach to the piano amplified this anomalous vision of the future of jazz. On top of a fairly traditional stride style, he would add flourishes and asides of the most amazing sort, bursts of dissonant chords, whole tone scales, unexpected percussive attacks, or querulous arpeggios. Ellington solo piano versions of Black Beauty and Swampy River from October 1, 1928 already revealed the foundations of this distinctive school of pianism, one that echoed the stride of Willie the Lion Smith and anticipated the astringency of Thelonious Monk and Cecil Taylor. But Ellington's piano skills were featured all too rarely during these years, with his band now serving more and more as a voice for his musical ambitions. It is especially illuminating to compare Ellington's big band charts from the late 1920s with Don Redman's efforts for Henderson and other bands. Redman's writing is packed full with musical activity, call and responses, breaks, dense section work, repeated rhythmic figures, and other devices. Ellington's arrangements are much sparser, more focused, less frenetic. This clarity and balance stood out whether Ellington was writing mood pieces, Black Beauty, Misty Morning, his so-called jungle pieces, The Mooch, or even standard blues, Beggar Blues, The Blues with a Feeling, while, with a few exceptions, even the showy up-tempo numbers maintain a cohesive musical identity. an atomistic stream of consciousness compilation of devices along the lines of what Redman attempted in his Whiteman Stomp, had no place in Duke's holistic music. The maturing of Ellington's compositional skills and the influx of new soloists served to buffer the impact of Bubber Miley's departure from the group in 1929. Ellington, who usually preferred to avert his gaze from his band members' various indiscretions, apparently fired Miley after the trumpeter consistently showed up disheveled and intoxicated or missed entire performances. "Every time some big shot come up to listen to the band, there wasn't no Bubber Miley," explained Cootie Williams, "and he had the whole band built around Bubber Miley. That's the only man Ellington ever fired in his life." Williams stepped in as Miley's replacement, and though he had never heard Miley play in person and was given little direction by Duke, he soon developed a growl style of his own. "One night I had the plunger, and I said, 'Wah, wah,' and I woke everybody up, and they said, 'That's it, keep on.'" Williams, like so many others, maintained a career-long partnership with Ellington. This initial stint would continue until 1940, while a second association with the orchestra would last from 1962 until the band leader's death in 1974. Duke's brass section was further reinforced during this period by the addition of trombonists Juan Tizol in 1929 and Lawrence Brown in 1932, initiating an association with Ellington that, for both, would last many years. Tizol was seldom featured in solos with the band, but he contributed Caravan and Perdido, two pieces that would become widely played jazz standards, as well as lesser-known gems such as Moonlight Fiesta and Pyramid. Brown's buttery trombone tone, at times reminiscent of the sound of a cello, was highlighted on a number of Ellington pieces, including The Sheik of Araby, Ducky Wucky, Slippery Horn, and Stompy Jones. But over and above their musical contributions, these two players also provided a much-needed anchor of stability in a group prone to peccadilloes. Brown was a minister's son who avoided alcohol, smoking, and gambling. Tizol, whose vices were restricted to an occasional drink and a penchant for practical jokes, set a new standard for punctuality in the band. Known to arrive a half hour or an hour before engagements, Tizol was subjected to his colleagues' ribbing about his conscientiousness. But when Ellington could not attend a rehearsal, he often entrusted the band to Tizol's demanding supervision. Duke's ascendancy during the Cotton Club years enabled him not only to weather the onset of the Great Depression, but even to flourish at a time when most band leaders needed to retrench. Ellington's group was one of the most widely recorded jazz ensembles of the period, while regular radio broadcasts further expanded his audience. In 1930, Ellington made the jump to the silver screen, participating in his first Hollywood movie, Check and Double Check, and appeared with Maurice Chevalier at New York's Fulton Theater. In 1931, Ellington was invited to meet President Hoover at the White House, a rare honor for a black jazz musician. After leaving the Cotton Club that same year, Ellington embarked on a series of highly profitable tours. Traveling in their own Pullman car, bringing their own lighting equipment, sporting different uniforms for each show, even if there were four or five shows in a day, the Ellington Band conveyed an aura of slick professionalism that few, if any, African-American groups of that era could match. And the critical accolades also started coming Duke's way. In 1932, R.D. Darrell, a conservatory-trained musician who served as critic for a number of influential periodicals, wrote a prescient and detailed study of Ellington's music, rhapsodizing over the band leader's noble and spontaneous unforced melodies, which spring into being as simply, as naturally as those of Mozart or Schubert. In November 1932, Percy Grainger, the distinguished composer and chairman of the music department at New York University, invited Ellington and his orchestra to play for a classroom of students and distinguished guests. Grainger took the occasion to compare Ellington's work to that of Bach and Delius. This high-flung praise from the bastions of classical music did little to quell Ellington's desire for greater popular success. In the past, he had avoided hiring a full-time singer for the band, but now brought in Ivy Anderson as a featured vocalist. It was not lost on Ellington that the public's musical tastes were, more and more, gravitating toward singers. Indeed, Duke's replacement at the Cotton Club, Cab Calloway, would never inspire comparisons to Bach or Schubert, but his scat-jai vocals, epitomized in the Heidi-Do call-and-response effects of his hit Minnie the Moocher, delighted audiences. Calloway had led the Alabamians in Chicago and later the Missourians in New York, and in 1929 had appeared in the review Hot Chocolates before securing the coveted Cotton Club job. Incorporating a heavy dose of novelty songs and scat vehicles into a more conventional hot jazz sound, Calloway achieved a celebrity and record sales to rival Ellington's at the time. The addition of Anderson gave a new dimension to Duke's band, and though she may have lacked the eccentric individualism of a Calloway, or many of the other Ellington sidemen for that matter, she was one of the most versatile jazz singers of her era, equally capable of heartfelt ballads, growling scat singing, or wistful blues. The presence of a vocalist was just one of several factors that served to crystallize Ellington's growing interest in popular songs. Irving Mills, in his careful management of Duke's affairs, was especially sensitive to the commercial potential of the bandleader's skills as a tunesmith. In truth, Mills's role went far beyond the usual promotional activities and apparently extended to creative matters. Although he is listed as Ellington's collaborator on many pieces, the exact scope of Mills's contribution to Duke songwriting is a matter of dispute. However, it is likely that he made suggestions on the types of tunes that might be popular, encouraged Ellington to simplify the often dense textures of his compositions, and arranged to have lyrics written. For his own part, Ellington did not shy away from the opportunities presented by the growing market for popular music. Ellington's compositional output was still meager compared to the burst of creativity he would experience in the late 1930s. He copyrighted more songs in 1938 and 1939 than the rest of the decade combined. Even so, these early years of the Depression would see the debut of many of his most memorable and lasting songs, including Mood Indigo, It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing, Sophisticated Lady, Solitude, and In a Sentimental Mood. And though he would never challenge a Gershwin or Berlin as a hitmaker, Ellington's melodies were too complex, too rooted in the vertical conception of a jazz pianist for that to happen. His body of work as Tin Pan Alley songsmith would be impressive, even if he had never led a band or performed as a pianist. Throughout the decade, these forays into popular music coexisted with Duke's more ambitious attempts to raise jazz to the level of art music. As early as his 1931 work, Creole Rhapsody, Ellington was fighting against the constraints of 78 RPM recordings, tackling a longer form that required the label to use both sides of the disc to contain this single performance. Two versions of the piece were recorded that year, one issued on the Brunswick label that lasted 6 minutes, while the extended arrangement for Victor took over 8 minutes, requiring it to be issued on a 12-inch record. Although this piece is not wholly satisfying, the melodic material is fairly simple-minded, the structural complexity and effective shifts in mood, especially on the Victor version, clearly revealed Ellington's aspirations to extend the range of jazz music far beyond the conventions of the day. This path-breaking attempt at extended composition would soon be surpassed by Ellington's Symphony in Black, 1934, not a true symphony but rather a 9-minute suite in 4 parts that incorporated music from several earlier Ellington pieces, and by his 13-minute Reminiscing in Tempo, 1935, which in its compositional intricacy and strong melodic and harmonic material proved to be the most fully realized longer work that Ellington had yet written. If Ellington felt any doubts about his ability to develop an audience for his more serious works, the band's 1933 trip to Europe certainly put them to rest. Even before Ellington's arrival, Spike Hughes had announced in Melody Maker that America does not honestly know or appreciate the real treasure she possesses in Duke Ellington. A 2-week engagement at the Palladium drew fans from all over the country who were anxious to hear Ellington's English debut. Ellington had brought along dancer Bessie Dudley and song and dance team Bill Bailey and Derby Wilson in an attempt to create a Cotton Club-styled revue in this new setting. Much to his surprise, many of the critics and musicians who had heralded the bandleader as the great new American composer expressed dismay at the show business trappings of these performances. In response to their demands, Duke added a number of his more ambitious pieces to the band's program. "Maybe our music does mean something," was Ellington's characteristically understated comment on his return to America. Although the serious tone of this response must have been gratifying to Ellington, this was no time for complacency. An exciting swing band led by Jimmy Lunsford had recently arrived in Harlem, ready to challenge Ellington for supremacy on his home turf. Organized in Memphis in the late 1920s, the Lunsford Band had polished its approach during summer engagements in Lakeside, Ohio, and then built up a following in Buffalo, New York, before finally coming to Harlem to appear at the Cotton Club. Lacking the depth of soloists and originality of the Ellington Band, the Lunsford Orchestra compensated with exceptionally fluid ensemble work, a tightly knit rhythm section, and a repertoire of solidly swinging dance charts. Coming of age only a short while before the dawn of the swing era, as the second half of this decade would come to be known, Lunsford was anticipating the sound of the future. Streamlined, stylish, and swinging, this was a band well suited to the emerging musical tastes of the American public. Lunsford had learned several instruments during his youth in Denver, and had formally studied music at Fisk University and the City College of New York. As a bandleader, however, he remained content to delegate much of the direction of the group to others. Will Hudson's 1934 charts Jazzocracy and White Heat, evoking memories of the Casa Loma Orchestra, provided Lunsford with his first recording success. But it was left to trumpeter and arranger Cy Oliver to develop the mature sound of the group, with its winning interplay of brass, reeds, and rhythm instruments. In a series of memorable charts, such as Shake Your Head, 1934, My Blue Heaven, 1935, Organ Grinder Swing, 1936, and For Dancers Only, 1937, Oliver set out a blueprint for crafting dancehall music of the highest order. This approach would be widely imitated by other swing bands over the following decade, and Oliver himself would resurface in other settings, most notably with Tommy Dorsey's band, to create similar successes. These carefully structured pieces have given the Lunsford Group the reputation of being primarily an arranger's band. However, the Lunsford Orchestra was not lacking in talented soloists. Willie Smith, whose sophisticated and sweet-toned saxophone work places him behind only Benny Carter and Johnny Hodges among altoists of the decade, stands out as the most capable of the group's instrumentalists. But the contributions of Trummy Young, Eddie Durham, and Joe Thomas are also worth noting. Even the heralded ensemble sound of the Lunsford Band was as much a matter of individual musicianship as of arranging style. The technical facility and relaxed phrasing of the reed section, as seen, for example, in the 1935 performances of Sleepy Time Gal, were unsurpassed at the time. And though the brass section may have lacked the unique musical personalities who enlivened the Ellington Ensemble, the range and execution of Lunsford's individual players were beyond reproach. Drummer Chick Webb also made an impact on the Harlem musical landscape during these years. A Baltimore native, Webb came to New York in his mid-teens and before his 20th birthday was leading a band at Harlem's Savoy Ballroom. Webb demands our respect as one of the most exciting drummers in the history of jazz, but his reputation suffers from four factors: his relatively short career, the limited ability of 1930s recording technology to capture percussion sounds in a big band with any real immediacy, his unprepossessing appearance in an industry that celebrates image and glamour more than it will admit, and finally, and the only one of these obstacles that Webb brought upon himself, his decision to hire a singer whose fame would soon eclipse the achievements of her erstwhile boss. Yet if the history books have been unkind to Chick Webb, jazz fans at the time had no doubts about his preeminence. Relying on the imaginative compositions and charts of Edgar Sampson, Stompin' at the Savoy, Blue Lou, Let's Get Together, and propelled by the leader's forceful drumming, Webb's band developed into a hard-swinging ensemble, primed to compete with Ellington or Henderson at the legendary band battle staged at the Savoy. For a famous matchup with the Goodman Band, held at the Savoy in 1937, a record crowd of 4,000 packed the hall, while another 5,000 were turned away. Chick Webb defeats Ben Goodman, proclaimed the follow-up headline in Metronome. The addition of singer Ella Fitzgerald to the band in 1934 further enhanced the group's jazz credentials and added to its popular appeal. While her vocal on A Tisket a Tasket propelled the song to an 18-week stint on the hit parade in 1938. Fitzgerald had been discovered at age 17 in a talent contest at Harlem's Apollo Theater and soon gained a reputation for her wide range, impeccable intonation, and sure sense of swing. A Tisket a Tasket, with its nursery song quality, proved to be an ideal vehicle for Fitzgerald's childlike vocal style, a style that stood in stark contrast to the sultry sexuality and dark moodiness of a Bessie Smith or a Billie Holiday. Bringing a naive innocence to her interpretation of a lyric, Fitzgerald conveyed a joyous exultation, tinged with a sense of humor, reminiscent of her early model Louis Armstrong, with whom she later collaborated in a memorable pairing. When Webb died from tuberculosis in 1939, Fitzgerald took over as leader and continued in that role for the next 3 years, until the group disbanded in 1942. Ellington, Henderson, Lunsford, Calloway, Webb, Fitzgerald. These band leaders represented a flowering of musical talent in Harlem, every bit as vital as the community's much-heralded writers and visual artists. The work of these African-American musicians came to exert an influence far beyond the confines of Harlem, playing a critical role in defining the broader cultural taste.